That would require decisive action. What did that mean? Eden gave an answer a few hours later in the House of Commons. Following the script he and his co-conspirators had written, he delivered an ultimatum to Israel and Egypt. Britain and France called upon both states to cease fighting, to withdraw their troops from a 10-mile zone along the Suez Canal, and to accept the stationing there of Anglo-French forces to ensure continued operation of the canal. Egypt and Israel were given 12 hours to respond, and if they refused, the Anglo-French forces would launch an invasion of the canal zone. In a phone call with Eisenhower, Foster Dulles called the ultimatum as crude and brutal as anything he had ever seen, and predicted that, by tomorrow, they will be in. Later in the day, Dulles met with the British and French ambassadors and tore into them, calling this the blackest day which has occurred in many years in the relations between England and France and the United States. He declared that their action would damage NATO and the UN, and all but accused both nations of collusion with the Israelis. Perhaps most galling, the Anglo-French action may well obliterate the success we have long awaited in Eastern Europe, by giving the Soviets the cover they needed to crush Hungary. Dulles's words packed months of anger and resentment into a few moments of unadulterated hostility. Eisenhower shared Dulles's fury. In the afternoon of October 30th, while meeting with Arthur Fleming, the director of defense mobilization, to review the global impact of the Israeli invasion upon the world's oil supplies, Eisenhower said he was extremely angry at his allies. He expected that world oil markets would be thrown into disarray, that the British and French would soon need to find alternative sources of oil, and would find themselves short of dollars to finance these operations. Anticipating a sudden increase in his leverage over his ill-behaved friends, Eisenhower mused that Britain and France were going to have a rough time of it, and should be left to boil in their own oil, so to speak. 1 week away from a presidential election, Eisenhower had to face the domestic politics of the crisis. In a harsh attack, Adlai Stevenson denounced the blundering vacillation of the Eisenhower team toward events in Hungary and the Middle East. He claimed Dulles had appeased the Soviets over Hungary while alienating America's closest friends, including Israel. Adams, in a telephone call with Dulles, confessed his own concerns about how Eisenhower looks to the country and to the world. The British and the French had trapped us, he said, and he implied that the Allies had made Eisenhower look weak. He suggested that the president should address the nation and explain America's response to the growing crisis. Dulles agreed. That evening, the UN Security Council debated a resolution calling for Israel to withdraw its forces from Egypt. In an unprecedented development, the United States and the Soviet Union supported the measure, but Britain and France vetoed it. The next day, October 31st, with the Egyptians having scorned the Western ultimatum, British and French forces began to bomb Egyptian airfields, ports, railways, and radio towers. They justified these air attacks as a necessary preliminary operation before their troops could land and secure the canal. Eisenhower and the United States had been ignored. The crisis in Suez had cleft the Western alliance in two. Emmett Hughes described the atmosphere in the White House on October 31st as thick and heavy with righteous wrath against Britain. The president seemed deflated by the treachery of his wartime allies. "I just don't know what got into those people," he sighed. "It's the damnedest business I ever saw supposedly intelligent governments get themselves into." Eisenhower at last consented to Adams's request that he speak to the nation on television, triggering a whirlwind of activity as the staff now drafted and redrafted the president's remarks. Eisenhower hit golf balls in the White House lawn while Hughes raced to write a 15-minute speech that recounted the recent events, explained American policy, and avoided too much direct criticism of America's NATO allies. At 4 minutes before 7 p.m., Hughes handed Eisenhower the last page of the text, typed in large print with key passages underlined for emphasis. Dressed in a trim gray suit, seated at his desk in the Oval Office under glaring spotlights, Eisenhower seemed the most calm man in the room. At 7 on the dot, the president began to speak. His remarks aimed above all to reassure the public that the events in Hungary and Suez would not lead to an American war. He spent half his time praising the courageous Hungarians for their devotion to freedom and calling on the Soviets to respect Hungarian independence. He then admonished the British and French for violating Egypt's sovereignty, though he hastened to condemn Egypt's behavior in purchasing Soviet weapons and nationalizing the Suez Canal. The invasion he described as an error. America, he pointedly said, was not consulted in any way beforehand. He insisted that the whole affair be taken to the United Nations and resolved with respect for international law. There can be no peace without law, he concluded, and there can be no law if we invoke one code of international conduct for those who oppose us and another for our friends. The Los Angeles Times praised Eisenhower's calm, mature appeal for peace and justice and applauded the nation's competent pilot. But the Washington Post editorial page, while admitting that the mess in the Middle East was not Eisenhower's fault, nonetheless stated that American policy or a lack of policy has failed. And columnist Walter Lippmann, a reliable critic of the administration, piled on. Eisenhower's criticism of Israel amounted to a grave mistake. Lippmann saw Nasser as an implacable enemy with a plan to become master of the Arab world, and all Eisenhower seemed to offer was appeasement. The results spoke for themselves. The fires of war now burned across the Middle East, NATO was shattered, the Soviets were running roughshod over Hungary, and Eisenhower's call for peace was ignored. If Eisenhower was going to show leadership and actually impose order on these sad events, he had waited long enough. 6. Anyone wishing to make the case for Eisenhower as a master of the arts of politics and diplomacy need only look to the first 10 days of November 1956. In these anxious hours, any mistake or miscalculation could have led to global war. Eisenhower demonstrated uncanny discipline, steadfast leadership, and cool judgment. No less than John F. Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Eisenhower managed the dispute over Suez with assurance and wisdom that headed off what could easily have become a far more deadly conflagration. At 9 a.m. on November 1st, the president convened the National Security Council. The discussion turned first to Eastern Europe. CIA Director Dulles informed the group that a miracle had occurred in Hungary. In order to ease popular unrest, the Hungarian communist leadership, with Soviet approval, had installed the moderate Imre Nagy as prime minister, hoping he could use his popularity with the people to stem the rebellion. The Soviet troops, which for days had been locked in fierce conflict with the Hungarians, appeared to be withdrawing. Nagy, perhaps inflamed by the intense anti-Soviet emotions in the streets of Budapest, asserted Hungary's independence. On October 30th, he announced the end of one-party rule in Hungary and the revival of multi-party democracy. This opened the way to the formation of a coalition government made up of members of the once-outlawed non-communist parties. On October 31st, in his boldest move, Nagy declared the Hungarian government's intention to withdraw from the Warsaw Pact. Astonishingly, the Soviets made no move to challenge Nagy's apostasy. While the NSC cheered this outcome as a defeat of Soviet imperialism in Europe, the apparent Soviet tolerance for Nagy's neutralist actions presented the Western powers with a dilemma. By appearing to respect Hungary's independence, the USSR positioned itself on the moral high ground at the United Nations, from which it could more effectively denounce the invasion of Egypt. Soviet restraint in Hungary, therefore, only intensified the need for Eisenhower to keep up American criticism of the Anglo-French-Israeli invasion of Suez lest the United States be seen as condoning aggression at the very moment the Soviets were tolerating Hungarian neutralism. This concern not to be outfoxed by the Soviets and to avoid being tarnished by the brush of old-fashioned European colonialism preoccupied Eisenhower. These colonial powers were going downhill, he stated emphatically. How could we possibly support Britain and France if in doing so we lose the whole Arab world? Nothing would ever induce the United States to abandon its oldest allies. Still, he insisted, if we did not do something to indicate some vigor in the way of asserting our leadership, the Soviets would take over the leadership from us. For this reason, he and Foster Dulles together worked out the language of a fairly mild resolution to be introduced in the General Assembly of the United Nations, where the British and French could not exercise a veto. The resolution called for a ceasefire and the withdrawal of combatant forces from Egypt. At the same time, on Eisenhower's orders, Dulles announced that the United States would suspend all shipments of military supplies to the area of hostilities. Since the United States had already suspended military sales to Egypt, this effectively meant cutting off military aid to Israel. This was an unprecedented, even shocking, step. 1 week before the presidential election, Eisenhower announced the cutoff of military aid to Israel, at the very moment Israel was fighting an Arab state with clear Soviet sympathies. And his Secretary of State strongly agreed with the decision. In response to a vigorous challenge launched in the NSC by Harold Stassen, who argued for accepting the Israeli seizure of Sinai as a fait accompli and backing Israel, Dulles bristled, "We do not approve of murder. We have simply got to refrain from resort to force in settling international disputes." Throughout the crisis, Eisenhower consistently held to this position, even though some in his cabinet and many in the press disagreed. He went so far as to record his views in a secret memorandum for the record. He wrote that Israel should not assume that winning a domestic election is as important to us as preserving and protecting the interests of the United Nations and other nations of the free world in that region. Eisenhower did not veer from this belief. Indeed, the president personally shaped American policy in these trying days. Following the long and tumultuous debate among the NSC members on November 1st, Eisenhower sent a short strategy paper to Dulles so there could be no ambiguity about the policy he wanted. "The United States must lead," he wrote. The first order of business was to secure a ceasefire in Egypt. Eisenhower feared that if the United States did not act quickly, the USSR would introduce a harshly worded resolution against Britain, France, and Israel, compelling a U.S. veto and thus putting us in an acutely embarrassing position. Above all, the Soviets must be prevented from seizing the mantle of world leadership. In essence, Ike wanted to discipline his own side in the Cold War, so he could sustain the narrative that the Soviet Union, not the Western powers, was the true source of conflict and trouble in the world. On the afternoon of November 1st, Dulles flew to New York to make his case at the UN. He proposed a ceasefire and the withdrawal of all combatant forces and urged all UN members to refrain from sending any military supplies to the conflict zone. In fact, Dulles wanted to do more than squelch a brushfire war in Sinai. Speaking before the General Assembly on the world stage, Dulles sought to portray America as an impartial adjudicator of world affairs. In a moving and obviously heartfelt address, he told the General Assembly, "The United States finds itself unable to agree with three nations with which it has ties of deep friendship, of admiration, and of respect, and two of which constitute our oldest and most trusted and reliable allies." It was a public slap in the face for Britain and France. Dulles acknowledged that Egypt was hardly blameless in the affair and had aggravated relations with its neighbors. But whenever a nation feels it has been subjected to injustice, it should have the right to resort to force in an attempt to correct that injustice, then I fear that we should be tearing the UN Charter into shreds, that the world would again be a world of anarchy, that the great hopes placed in this organization and in our charter would vanish. Unlike so many interventions at the UN, Dulles' speech won great acclaim. His resolution garnered 64 votes, with only 5 nations, Britain, France, and Israel, joined by Australia and New Zealand, voting against. The world had rallied to America's leadership. That evening, Eisenhower used a major speech to reinforce Dulles' message. Though he had canceled all but one of his campaign events because of the world crisis, Ike knew his appearance before 18,000 wildly enthusiastic Republicans in Philadelphia's convention hall would draw the nation's attention. Rising above partisan politics, he reminded his listeners of the grave events in the world. "We have heard with deep dismay the crack of rifle fire and the whine of jet bombers over the deserts of Egypt." In such an anxious time, he asked, "What does America stand for? What are the marks of America, and what do they mean to the world?" He gave a clear answer. Americans believed in the rule of law. That principle had won the admiration of so many millions of the world's peoples. America was a land without class or caste, a country that did not judge a man by his name or inheritance. It was America's mission to uphold the rule of law around the world. There can be no second-class nations before the law of the world community. Eisenhower acknowledged that the crisis in the Middle East posed a test of our principles, because it asked Americans to choose between friendship with old allies and respect for the law. But America had made its choice and would uphold the integrity of the law of nations. "We cannot proclaim this integrity when the issue is easy, and stifle it when the issue is hard. Law must govern nations just as it must govern free peoples. We cannot and we will not condone armed aggression, no matter who the attacker and no matter who the victim." More than a campaign speech, Eisenhower's remarks revealed his deep devotion to a world based upon law rather than force. These dual public speeches by Dulles and Eisenhower put heavy pressure on the British Prime Minister. Eden, who for so many years had labored in Churchill's shadow, believed that his coup against Nasser would secure his place among the great British leaders of the century. He wanted to show the world that the British Empire endured. But it had all turned to ashes in his mouth. Not only had the U.S. President firmly rebuked the British, but the UN, following America's lead, had spoken almost with one voice to condemn the invasion of Egypt, to denounce the warlike actions of the Anglo-French forces, and to demand the withdrawal of all combatants. And Eden faced even more terrible news. His actions had placed Britain's oil supply in jeopardy. In retaliation for the invasion of Suez, the Syrians destroyed 3 pipelines that carried oil from Kirkuk in Iraq to the Mediterranean for shipment to Europe. These pipelines carried 500,000 barrels of oil a day and amounted to a quarter of Europe's Middle East imports. And the Egyptians sank old trawlers and barges in the narrows of the Suez Canal itself to halt all traffic, a sure way to interrupt the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. In a matter of weeks, British oil supplies would dry up. Eden had brought world opprobrium on Britain and placed his country on the brink of an economic crisis. When, on November 3rd, Eden defended his Suez policy in the House of Commons, Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell ripped into him, calling on Eden to accept the UN ceasefire or risk shaming Britain in the eyes of the world. In a tumultuous debate, Labour members shouted down the government ministers with cries of, "Resign!" Huge crowds staged anti-war protests in Trafalgar Square. Even reliably pro-Tory newspapers, such as the Times of London and The Observer, denounced Eden's policy as ill-conceived and illegal. Eden had gone too far to flinch now, however. Late in the evening of November 3rd, while French and British aircraft continued to bomb Egyptian targets, the pain-racked but impeccably groomed Prime Minister appeared on British national television. He confidently explained that the lessons of appeasement from the previous war demanded a confrontation with Nasser. There are times for courage, times for action, and this is one of them. It was Nasser, not Britain, who threatened world peace with his illegal seizure of the canal and his terroristic border raids against Israel. These actions had in turn triggered the Israeli invasion. Britain and France merely wished to restore order, ensure the smooth functioning of the canal, and separate the warring parties. Nasser's failure to respond to the Anglo-French request to withdraw from the canal zone had made the use of force inevitable. It was strong medicine, Eden implied, but Nasser would have to take it until he was cured of his aggressive habits. Britain and France, then, would move ahead with their plans for a land invasion of the Suez Canal. Hoping to forestall this, the Canadian delegation at the UN, with strong American backing, proposed the creation of a UN peacekeeping force that would enter the canal zone and do the job that Britain had arrogated to itself. On the evening of November 3rd, the UN endorsed this proposal by an overwhelming vote of 57 to nothing. The British and French abstained. But it was a race to see who would get there first, British and French soldiers or the blue-helmeted UN troops. In the midst of this whirlwind, Eisenhower faced more unsettling news. Very late on the night of November 2nd, Foster Dulles had been taken to Walter Reed Hospital after suffering severe stomach pain. The doctors initially thought he might have appendicitis, but it soon became apparent that the 68-year-old had colon cancer. On November 4th, surgeons removed a tumor from his large intestine. Eisenhower visited Dulles soon after the surgery and remarked to General Leonard Heaton, the surgeon who had so recently opened up the president's own abdomen, "Take good care of the boy. I need him." Dulles remained at Walter Reed for the next 2 weeks and did not return to full-time work until January. In the meantime, Herbert Hoover, Jr., son of the former president and an engineer with an extensive background in the oil business, stood in as acting Secretary of State. The absence of Dulles did not substantially change U.S. policy, though it left Eisenhower without his most loyal, most reliable lieutenant. Eisenhower and Dulles were not warm friends, although they spoke on the phone almost every day, sometimes two or three times a day, and had developed a close partnership. Dulles served the president like a lawyer serves his most important and valuable client, with tenacity and obsequious devotion. Dulles would take the reins of U.S. foreign policy again, but the cancer never retreated. He had only a little more than 2 years left to live. 7. Just as Eisenhower began to despair about the Middle East, terrible news arrived from Hungary. The Soviets were invading again, and this time, they meant to win. The Soviet Union had installed Imran Nagy in power on October 24th with the intention of using this moderate and reform-minded leader to quell the Hungarian uprising. Instead, Nagy had been captured by the euphoria of the anti-Soviet rebellion and declared Hungary's intention to leave the communist bloc, setting off a panicked reaction in the Kremlin. Khrushchev and his colleagues worried that if Hungary could slip away from communist control, just when Egypt, a potential client state, was being invaded by the Europeans, the West would have delivered a dual blow to Soviet prestige. In a secret meeting on October 31st, Khrushchev and the Soviet Presidium ordered the preparation of Operation Whirlwind, the repression of the Hungarian Revolution by over 60,000 Soviet troops. The blow fell savagely at 4 a.m. on November 4th. Artillery shells slammed into the center of Budapest. Soviet troops moved swiftly into the city, capturing the radio broadcasting stations and munitions depots. They surrounded the Hungarian army barracks and disarmed the troops. They occupied all the bridges across the Danube and then seized the parliament building. Soviet troops were met with fierce but sporadic and uncoordinated resistance. Prime Minister Nagy went on national radio to declare, "At daybreak, Soviet forces started an attack against our capital. obviously with the intention to overthrow the legal Hungarian government. Our troops are fighting. The government is in its place. But that was not the case. Frnaj himself then fled to the Yugoslav embassy, leaving his government in disarray. By noon, most of the city was under Soviet control. The Hungarian Revolution, which had electrified captive people across Europe, lay crushed beneath Soviet tank treads. These events shocked the confused and anxious world. At the United Nations, Ambassador Lodge rose to denounce the Soviet invasion. He was met with a sneering, dismissive rebuttal from the Soviet ambassador, who asserted that the Western powers merely wanted to divert attention from the fiasco at Suez. The State Department hastily drafted a message for the president to send to the Soviet leadership, declaring his profound distress at reports of Soviet brutality in Hungary. The ambassador to Italy, Claire Booth Luce, an outspoken hawk and Eisenhower's friend, wrote Ike a private cable calling for action to rescue the Hungarians. "Let us not ask for whom the bell tolls in Hungary today. It tolls for us if freedom's holy light is extinguished in blood and iron there." But Eisenhower understood there were no measures the United States could take to halt Soviet aggression. Hungary was landlocked and surrounded by Warsaw Pact countries. Any intervention there would certainly lead to a wider war. As he candidly wrote later in his memoirs, "We could do nothing." On the Suez matter, however, Eisenhower did have some leverage. But had he waited too long to use it? When he arrived at the Oval Office on the morning of November 5th, he found on his desk an overnight cable from Eden, offering an unrepentant explanation for the British police action in Suez. The message was timed to arrive with the depressing news that at dawn, British and French paratroopers had landed in the Suez Canal zone, just the outcome Eisenhower most wished to avoid. Eden hoped to soften the blow, asserting, "This is the moment to curb Nasser's ambitions. If we draw back now, chaos will not be avoided. Everything will go up in flames in the Middle East." Even as the president met with his advisers, Anglo-French units were fighting in Port Said, taking control of the key access point into the Suez Canal. The Anglo-French landings stirred the Soviets into action. Their invasion of Hungary had produced an avalanche of global criticism, and they were all too keen to redirect the world's focus to the Suez crisis. Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet premier and titular head of state, delivered a barrage of public messages to world capitals. To Israel, Britain, and France came a searing condemnation and direct threat: withdraw from Egypt or face Soviet military action. "We are fully determined to crush the aggressors and restore peace in the East through the use of force." At 2 p.m., the premier's message to Eisenhower clattered out of the telex machine. Bulganin denounced Anglo-French military operations and demanded that the invaders accept the UN ceasefire resolution of November 1st. Then came a shocking proposal that the United States and USSR send a joint task force to Egypt to pull apart the warring nations, impose peace, and restore order. "If this war is not stopped," Bulganin darkly concluded, "it is fraught with danger and can grow into a third world war." Coming at the very moment the Soviets were slaughtering Hungarians in the streets of Budapest, Bulganin's outrage at Anglo-French aggression in Egypt revealed the worst kind of cynicism. Even so, Ambassador Charles Bolin in Moscow urged the president not to dismiss the Soviet proposal as mere propaganda. The Soviets might be laying the ground for an intervention in the Middle East on the grounds of resisting imperialist aggression. They probably did not want to start World War III, Bolin said, but they no longer seemed content to sit on the sidelines. Eisenhower had predicted that the USSR would use the crisis in Egypt as an opportunity to spread its own influence in the region. It had been preoccupied with the Hungarian affair. Now it seemed ready to exploit the Suez conflict to its advantage. Meeting with Hoover and other senior aides in the afternoon, Eisenhower wanted a reply sent to Bulganin immediately with a clear warning to stay out. The Soviets were embarking on a wild adventure, perhaps because their invasion of Hungary had been such a stain on their public reputation. They were scared and furious and therefore liable to make very bad decisions. Emmett Hughes, who was present at the meeting, recalled that the lines and pallor of Eisenhower's face betrayed fatigue. It had been a dreadful and tense 2 weeks for the president. During those days he suffered from hypertension, his pulse was erratic, his head ached, his abdominal scar throbbed, and his stomach was bloated with gas. He consulted Dr. Snyder every few hours during these days of crisis. As he and his advisors crafted a response to Bulganin's challenge, Eisenhower's mind turned to the prospect of war. He was thinking, Hughes recalled, with cold realism and as commander-in-chief of the menace that seemed to him implicit in the Bulganin message. "You know," he said tautly, "we may be dealing here with the opening gambit of an ultimatum. We have to be positive and clear in our every word, every step. And if those fellows start something, we may have to hit 'em, and if necessary, with everything in the bucket." After a somber discussion, Eisenhower issued a statement to the press rejecting the Soviet proposal for a joint task force as unthinkable. The UN already had agreed to send a peacekeeping force to Suez once the ceasefire had been accepted. That decision must be respected. The United States, therefore, opposed any introduction of new forces. The message did not state unequivocally that the United States would use force to oppose a Soviet move to aid Egypt, but as the New York Times noted, that was the implication. On November 5th, the great powers seemed closer to a world war than at any time since 1945. 8. As Americans went to the polls on Election Day, November 6th, they surely carried with them into the voting booths the images from the front pages of their morning newspapers. The Soviet army had just invaded Budapest, killing as many as 2,000 Hungarians. Premier Bulganin had threatened to intervene in Egypt to halt the Anglo-French-Israeli invasion. British and French paratroopers continued to drop out of the Egyptian sky and were fighting for control of key points along the Suez Canal. Soviet MiG fighter aircraft had been spotted in Egypt. At any moment, the police action Eden had designed could erupt into a much wider and more deadly war. For Eisenhower, the day began with a worrisome intelligence briefing from Alan Dulles, who reported, "The Soviets told the Egyptians that they will do something in the Middle East hostilities." Just what they planned to do, Dulles could not say, though he suggested the Soviets might move aircraft to Syria in anticipation of a wider conflict. The president ordered Dulles to get U-2 planes over Syria as soon as possible to search for evidence of any such activity. Thinking of the vulnerable French and British planes and ships that were gathered in Cyprus, Eisenhower remarked that if the Soviets attacked the French and British directly, we would be in war. Shortly after 9 a.m., Eisenhower and Mamie got into a car for the 2-hour drive to Gettysburg, their official voting district. No sooner had they arrived and cast their ballots than Eisenhower got word from Washington that he needed to return immediately. He boarded the helicopter and was whisked back to the White House, where he landed just after noon. The immediate cause for alarm was a message from Ambassador Bolin in Moscow, which had arrived while Eisenhower was en route to Pennsylvania. He reported that the Soviet attitude had become ominous. The USSR seemed poised for some kind of military action to demonstrate its solidarity with the Arab world. Just after 12:30 p.m., the president went into a conference with his advisors and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Radford briefed Eisenhower on the steps that he proposed to take to increase America's military readiness in response to the recent Soviet statements. "Ike agreed that we should be in an advanced state of readiness, but he did not want to take any obviously provocative measure, such as calling for a general mobilization of active duty troops. Radford doubted the likelihood of a direct Soviet military move into the Mediterranean because they had no naval presence in the region. They could use long-range airstrikes with nuclear weapons, but he said that seemed unlikely. Eisenhower approved Radford's suggestion to send two aircraft carriers, the newly minted USS Forrestal and the USS Franklin Roosevelt, to the eastern Atlantic. He also approved putting the Continental Air Defense Command on increased readiness, thus sending more interceptor aircraft in the sky above the homeland. Eisenhower did not want to be the victim of a surprise Soviet attack. Mid-morning brought hopeful signs that the crisis might ease rather than worsen. The Israeli government told the UN Secretary General that it would agree to a ceasefire. And why not? By that time, Israel occupied all of the Sinai Peninsula and had destroyed much of the Egyptian army and air force. Its military aims had been achieved. Egypt, desperate to stem its losses, tentatively agreed to a ceasefire as well. In London, Eden was running out of time. At 9:45 a.m., the British cabinet convened to consider the news of the Israeli-Egyptian ceasefire. British soldiers had only just gained control of Port Said at the mouth of the canal. They had days of tough fighting ahead if they wanted to secure the entire canal zone. Eden was inclined to keep the invasion going. To halt military activities now would be an admission of failure and make Nasser look like the winner. Foreign Minister Selwyn Lloyd, however, could see the game was up. He reluctantly concluded that Britain must accept the ceasefire for three powerful reasons. First, the Soviet Union might well join the hostilities in the region, which would be a worldwide calamity. Second, the British had claimed all along that their invasion was mainly a police action designed to separate the Israelis and the Egyptians. Now that those nations had agreed to a ceasefire, there was no plausible excuse to continue an armed invasion of Suez. The third and most pressing reason was that Britain had come under terrific economic pressure as a result of the crisis. With the canal blocked and the Iraq pipeline closed, Britain had lost about a quarter of its daily oil supply. The only way it could offset those losses was to purchase oil elsewhere, mainly from the United States or Latin America. That required dollars, and Harold Macmillan, Chancellor of the Exchequer, reported that Britain's dollar reserves were evaporating at an alarming rate. Markets do not like war, and Britain had started one. Currency traders and national banks around the world were rapidly cashing in their British pounds for dollars, threatening to wipe out Britain's supply. Dependent on dollars to pay for oil imports, Britain could not survive long if its reserves disappeared. The British economy teetered on the brink, and only the Americans could help pull it back. Yet the Americans showed no inclination to help. The U.S. Treasury kept the pressure on the British government by blocking what in normal times would have been a simple request, the repatriation of dollars that Britain had supplied to the International Monetary Fund. The previous night, Macmillan had frantically called American officials to get them to release these British-owned dollars, but Treasury Secretary Humphrey refused to allow the transaction. Although no evidence exists to link Eisenhower to this decision, Humphrey never would have taken such an unfriendly position without the president's approval. Britain had come up against a basic reality. It could not act alone on the world stage without the support of the United States. Macmillan, who only 10 days earlier had adopted a most bellicose posture and fulminated about the need for Britain to act decisively against the upstart Egyptians, now told the cabinet that Britain was going bankrupt and must cease its military operations. Prime Minister Eden, exhausted, outmaneuvered by his allies, and losing confidence of his own cabinet, accepted the news stoically. He agreed that Britain must accept the ceasefire and appeal to the United States for immediate economic aid. Eisenhower, hearing this news from his ambassador in London, put through a call to Eden. "I can't tell you how pleased we are that you found it possible to accept the ceasefire," he said. hiding his feeling of triumph. Eden, smarting over what he perceived to be American disloyalty, was sullen. "We cease firing tonight," he repeated, unwilling to engage in a conversation. Ike said he was delighted. But he was not satisfied with only a ceasefire. Before approving any economic aid to Britain, Eisenhower wanted Eden to withdraw his troops from Egypt. The UN would send in a peacekeeping force now, and that force should have no troops from any of the Big Five: the United States, Britain, France, the USSR, and China. "You people ought to be able to withdraw very quickly." This hit Eden hard. He had assumed that he would be able to keep his forces in the Canal Zone, thus giving him leverage over the Egyptians if they should not cooperate. Eisenhower foiled him. "May I think that one over?" Eden said. "Yes," Ike replied. "Call me any time you please." 9. At 7 p.m., Washington time, the fighting in Egypt stopped, just as the first U.S. election returns began to roll in. The early results looked good. The safe Republican Northeast went solidly for Ike. Then the tallies from border states arrived. Delaware, Maryland, West Virginia, and Kentucky also went into the Republican column. Soon came the news that Eisenhower had broken open the solid Democratic South, winning Virginia, Tennessee, Florida, and Louisiana. "Louisiana," he exclaimed when Hughes told him he was leading there. "That's as probable as leading in Ethiopia." And so it went. By the time he made his way to Washington's Sheridan Park Hotel for the victory party, among 6,000 guffawing, back-slapping, tipsy Republican celebrants, Eisenhower was on his way to a great re-election victory. He won 41 states to Stevenson's 7, giving him 457 electoral votes to Stevenson's 73. He took 57% of the popular vote, the biggest share since FDR's landslide in 1936 over Alf Landon. Even in Stevenson's home state, Illinois, Eisenhower won 60% of the vote. Stevenson won only states that had once been part of the Confederacy, the South's sullen response to Eisenhower's moderate proposals on civil rights. Eisenhower became the first Republican in the 20th century to win two consecutive presidential elections. At 10 p.m., the giant billboard above Times Square in New York City blazed with the news of Eisenhower's triumph. It took Adlai Stevenson, sulking in his hotel room, another 4 hours to concede. "What in the name of God is the monkey waiting for?" fumed Ike. Not until 1:40 in the morning could the president enter the hotel ballroom to accept the cheers from his fans. Eisenhower's victory was due to his personal popularity and to the unprecedented prosperity over which he presided. But Americans also wanted an experienced leader at the helm in a time of crisis. The voting took place under pressure of extraordinary events overseas, James Reston wrote in the New York Times. Not since the election of 1944, when the Second World War was reaching its decisive phase, with the American armies deep in Germany, have the American people gone to the polls so preoccupied with alarming foreign policy developments. Americans overwhelmingly agreed. They wanted Eisenhower's steady hand to guide the country in this hour of crisis. There was still urgent work to be done, however, and no time for celebration. Early on the morning of November 7th, as the White House was savoring the election results, Prime Minister Eden called the president and asked if he could come to Washington to consult on the Suez matter, perhaps hoping that the personal touch would persuade Eisenhower to provide oil and financial aid to Britain. Eden obviously thought that since he had accepted the ceasefire, he would be forgiven his trespasses. Eisenhower, pleased by his electoral victory and eager to mend the frayed special relationship, accepted Eden's proposal. Sounding suddenly magnanimous, he said he wanted to clear up this family spat. As soon as Ike hung up the phone, his advisers rushed into his office. Sherman Adams, Staff Secretary Colonel Andrew Goodpaster, Herbert Hoover Jr., Treasury Secretary Humphrey, all strongly discouraged a personal visit, fearing that it would give Eden a reprieve before he had accepted the UN demand for withdrawal of all forces from Suez. An Eisenhower-Eden meeting now would send the Arab world into an uproar and forfeit all the gains Ike had made by holding to such a firm line against British policy. Reluctantly, Eisenhower accepted the point and phoned Eden back. It was an awkward call, with Ike stumbling to make his excuses. "We will have to postpone it a little bit," he said, pleading a sudden rush of other commitments. Eisenhower then motored to Walter Reed to visit Foster Dulles, still recovering from his surgery. They chatted about the election results briefly, then turned to Suez. For a man who had just undergone a major operation, Dulles was remarkably lucid. He described the British-French invasion as a crazy act, and insisted that any meeting with Eden must be contingent upon a withdrawal of troops. As long as those 15,000 British and 4,000 French soldiers sat in Port Said, the Egyptians would not cooperate and the Soviets would very soon take advantage of the disarray, perhaps sending forces of their own into the region. It was essential to get the UN police force to be made up of 3,000 Scandinavian, Indian, and Indonesian troops into position in Suez, and to get the Anglo-French forces out immediately. Upon returning to the White House, Eisenhower sent Eden a cable, reinforcing the message he had delivered over the phone. He desired that the UN force will promptly begin its work and the Anglo-French forces will be withdrawn without delay. Once these things are done, the ground will be favorable for our meeting. In short, Eisenhower would not welcome his old friend to the White House until the British had fully conformed to American wishes. The next day, in a prolonged NSC meeting, Eisenhower and his advisers discussed the acute oil crisis that Britain and Europe now faced. The falloff in oil deliveries due to the blocked canal and the destruction of the Iraq pipelines had been so severe that rationing of gasoline would soon have to start in Europe. The president was told that in the best-case scenario, the United States and Venezuela could ship to Europe at most 800,000 barrels of oil a day, and even that would leave the Europeans 10% to 15% short of their daily needs. Furthermore, Britain would use up its scarce supply of dollars in paying for these additional imports. Eisenhower understood the gravity of the problem, but decided to use the oil shortage to his advantage. He wanted to get the British and French to withdraw completely from the Suez Canal zone. To bail them out now, while their invasion forces remained in Suez, would get the Arabs sore at all of us, and they could embargo all oil. Alan Dulles added that prolonged instability in the region would play into Soviet hands, for they wanted to keep the pot boiling. Therefore, Ike refused to send Eden any reassuring signals. Instead, in a short and terse cable on November 11th, he urged Eden to withdraw all British troops from the canal zone with the utmost speed. Only then would there be any Anglo-American reconciliation. Eisenhower's firmness came as a terrible shock to the British. On November 12th, Macmillan told the cabinet that UK dollar reserves were dangerously low, and if the hemorrhaging did not stop, Britain would have to devalue its currency, thus delivering a death blow to the sterling area and the entire British Commonwealth. The only way to avoid this dire fate was immediate support from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, to the tune of $1.3 billion. Macmillan privately appealed for help to the U.S. Ambassador Winthrop Aldrich. "Why must the Americans be so rigid?" he wondered. "Did Ike not perceive that Britain was suffering? If Britain had to withdraw its forces now, without winning some kind of new international agreement to control the canal, the loss of prestige and humiliation would be so great that the government must fall." Macmillan, who is prone to rhetorical flights, told IMF President Eugene Black the next day that they were probably witnessing the end of Western civilization and that in another 50 years yellow and black men would take over. Such were the apocalyptic sentiments of the British leaders. The French, too, continued to stall on withdrawing from the Canal Zone. Prime Minister Guy Mollet spoke heatedly to the U.S. ambassador in Paris, Douglas Dillon, telling him that the Americans had failed to grasp the real problem in the Middle East, the Soviet threat. The Egyptians and Syrians were in cahoots with Moscow, he claimed, and were planning to destroy Israel and take over the Middle East. The American opposition to the Anglo-French strike against Nasser had prevented what might have been a brilliant coup against Soviet plans in the region. Instead, the prestige of the Soviets had been increased, and France and Britain faced a new Munich. But it was no use. Eisenhower did not budge. Even when the news came from Ambassador Aldrich that Eden had suffered a physical breakdown due to many weeks of sleepless nights and amphetamine use, the president remained firm. He directed Aldrich to let British leaders know that he sympathized with their financial difficulties, but they must leave Egypt. If we undertook commitments before the UK and French forces are withdrawn, we would be in the position of going back upon a matter of major principle. On November 23rd, Eden flew to Jamaica for what became a three-week period of rest and recovery, though it looked as if he was abandoning his post in a crucial hour. Britain was rudderless. That day Churchill, retired now and spending much of his time painting on the French Riviera, wrote the president begging him to close the rift that had opened up between Britain and America. "If we do not take immediate action in harmony," he solemnly wrote, "it is no exaggeration to say that we must expect to see the Middle East and North African coastline under Soviet control." Still, Eisenhower did not bend. In a lengthy reply to the former leader, Ike remarked that it was Eden who had created the problem by ignoring American advice and defying world opinion. "All we have asked," Ike said, "is that Britain conform to the resolutions of the United Nations." Once that was done, he wanted to see the affair washed off the slate as soon as possible. With Eden out of the country, Macmillan worked behind the scenes to bring the cabinet into line with American demands. The fall in reserves, he told his colleagues, had become desperate. The Americans would not help until Britain made a clear public statement of its intention to withdraw its troops from Egypt. On November 29th, the British cabinet, leaderless, facing an economic catastrophe, and knowing that only American aid could save the country, capitulated. On December 3rd, while Eden swam in the warm, silky waters of the Caribbean, Foreign Minister Lloyd announced to the House of Commons Britain's intention to withdraw its forces from Egypt. The Suez Crisis had ended. The British Empire was not far behind. 10. Reconciliation came quickly. Within hours of Lloyd's announcement, the U.S. government activated plans drawn up by the Office of Defense Mobilization to increase shipments of oil to Europe. Director Arthur Fleming reported that within 48 to 72 hours, the oil would begin to flow. Secretary Humphrey unlocked American dollars for Britain. By Christmas, Britain had received almost $2 billion in U.S.-backed loans. The closed American fist now unclenched and proffered the vital oil and dollars needed to keep Britain alive. A few weeks after his return from Jamaica, a ruined Anthony Eden resigned. But this was not the end of the story, for at the heart of the Suez Crisis lay a contest between the United States and the European powers about who would guide the future of the Middle East. Eisenhower had definitively answered that question. The invasion had discredited the Europeans, enraged Arab opinion, jeopardized Western access to Middle East oil, and opened the door to Soviet interference. The British and French, in Eisenhower's eyes, had forfeited any claim to influence in the Middle East. They had to leave, and the United States must now replace them. Ike understood that the Suez Crisis marked the start of a new American order in the Middle East, which would not be organized around colonies and empires. In his vision, the area would be held together by the appeal of American know-how, technology, economic aid, and military assistance, packaged to win the allegiance of conservative pro-Western Arab leaders who could protect Western interests. Where American offers of largesse were refused, the United States would find ways to punish defiance. Eisenhower asked Herbert Hoover Jr. at the State Department to draw up a study about what we could and should do for Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Libya, and even Egypt by holding out the carrot as well as the stick. Fears of Soviet interference fueled Eisenhower's anxiety about the need to move fast to replace the discredited Europeans. A telegram from Charles Bolin in Moscow about a recent meeting of the Central Committee of the Communist Party painted a worrisome picture. According to Bolin's source, the Soviet leadership concluded that the Middle East will be the focus of Soviet efforts in the future. Foreign Minister Dmitry Shapilov and Defense Minister Georgi Zhukov were exponents of the view that the Middle East represents a vital link which can be severed to cut West off from East. Destruction of Western position in Middle East will open Africa to Soviet influence and will permit denial to West of strategic bases, vital communications lines, raw materials, and markets. Turn your eyes to the South, Zhukov is reported to have told his colleagues, and Bolin's source added, Egypt and Syria are considered by Soviet leadership to be reliable instruments of Soviet policy in the Middle East. A military agreement with Syria was already inked and would supply the Syrians with tanks, artillery, armored trucks, and jet aircraft. There was not a moment to lose. Eisenhower and Dulles decided to make their bid for influence in the Middle East public by seeking a congressional resolution, just as they had done in the Formosa crisis. The resolution would give them a free hand to distribute the carrots of economic and military aid to friendly regimes in the Middle East, while authorizing the president to use the stick of military action against any communist threat. Such a public statement of American ambition in the Middle East might provoke a hostile reply from Moscow, but it was worth the risk. Eisenhower lobbied for the resolution with congressional leaders on New Year's Day, 1957. Middle East oil, he argued, was vital to Europe and to the West. If the Soviets seized it, the security of the United States would be directly at risk. He wanted to put the entire world on notice that we are ready to move instantly if necessary. They had to act quickly. Should there be a Soviet attack in that area, he could see no alternative but that the United States move in immediately to stop it. In the meantime, economic and military aid would help build pro-Western sentiment in the area and head off discontent in the region. The United States just cannot leave a vacuum in the Middle East and assume that Russia will stay out. By the time the president mounted the rostrum in the House of Representatives on January 5, 1957, to announce before a joint session of Congress what became known as the Eisenhower Doctrine, the restraint and caution that had characterized his actions during the Suez Crisis had vanished. It was as if a curtain had been pulled back on the real American strategy in the region. In his address, Eisenhower boldly asserted an American obligation to police the Middle East. The end of the colonial era, he explained, had opened promising new vistas for the emerging nations, but had also created instability that international communism now sought to exploit. Russia's rulers have long sought to dominate the Middle East. The United States must frustrate their plans. He asked Congress to approve a program of economic and military aid to friendly Middle East nations. He also asked Congress to permit the employment of the armed forces of the United States to secure and protect the territorial integrity and political independence of such nations, requesting such aid, against overt armed aggression from any nation controlled by international communism. Ike wanted a clear message sent to Moscow that the Middle East now formed part of America's beat in the world, and from now on, America would police it. This policy involves certain burdens and indeed risks for the United States, he solemnly noted. But Americans had already given billions of dollars and thousands of precious lives to the cause of freedom in Europe and Asia. The United States would expand its sphere of influence to ensure unfettered access to the black gold beneath the sand.